podcast is created as a part of the Podcast Lab by India Film Project in association with Anchor by Spotify. You, me, films, and the world is equal to this podcast. No, take two. You, me, and just geeking about films is equal to this podcast you're listening to. This is Around the World in 8mm. I am Prakhar Patidar and I talk films. In this podcast lab by India Film Project and Anchor by Spotify, of which this podcast Around the World in 8mm is part of, we were told that there's something called as the pod feed, which is that a lot of podcasts fail to reach the 10th episode because people lose motivation, the podcast fizzles out. So the 10th episode is kind of a milestone. Now that we're past that, I'm really thankful for the people who have been listening. No, actually, I've always been thankful for the people who have been listening. But it's surprising the amount of listens I've been getting, and I'm just really, really grateful. So yes, now that we're past the 10th episode, I'm thinking of experimenting with the form of the podcast. Nothing major, shorter episodes that emphasize on two or three aspects of the film rather than focusing on the whole film altogether. Or maybe TV series pilots, I don't know, we'll see. In the 10th episode, I mentioned that for the 11th one, we'd be going to a country whose popular culture has made a significant niche in the entertainment world, South Korea. Now, I know Korean cinema is as diverse as any other cinema, and it is not just a genre. Like, you don't watch a Korean film. You watch a Korean romance film or a Korean thriller film, but since revenge is such a prominent theme in the Korean cinema, whenever you are entering any film on the serious side of the spectrum, it is kind of difficult to not expect an angle of revenge in the plot. So that is what I went in with when I started watching The Handmaiden. And that's also the reason I did not pick any other popular Korean film like Old Boy or I Saw the Devil or Memories of a Murder, because Korean cinema and the theme of revenge has been talked about a lot, and this revenge aesthetic is so very gory, so artfully violent. Like, you should see those sequences. They get really squeamish really quick. The blood splatters too much, everything must be dealt with too much violence, and I'm not complaining. I don't belong to the screen violence makes one violent camp. I enjoy a violent film once in a while. Isn't it cathartic? You know, no one's really getting hurt, but to see it play out like safe sadism of sorts? I don't know. There's definitely art in making that violence appetizing, but I am digressing here. So yes, revenge is a prominent theme in Korean thrillers, and they know how to do this whole revenge thing very artistically. That is why I expected that to be there in The Handmaiden as well, given the kind of films Park Chan-wook has made before. And no doubt, it is the heart of the film, but the soul of this film is crafty eroticism via a lesbian love story. I am not spoiling this for you. A con man hires a young girl to manipulate a rich heiress into falling in love with him, but things take a different turn. You can expect this from the trailer itself. This is one of the films where I really want to talk about the characters, because our view of them constantly keeps changing, because with each act, our perspective changes. Three main characters, the con, the compliance, and the victim, and with each act, these three roles change for the characters. Talking too much about it would be spoiling the movie for you, and I really do not want to do that. So all I'll say is that there are a few twists and turns, and in the three acts of the film, we see each with a different character's point of view. New things are revealed to us which throw new light on the previous incidents. We start at point B, move to point C, back to point A, then jump to point C, to go back to point B, and finally walk to point D where the film ends. What are these points? Why don't you watch the film and text me? We can talk about it. What I do want to talk about in this episode is a little bit about colonial identity and eroticism in cinema, but first, about the plot. It is 1930s Korea, and Korea is under Japanese colonial rule. A con man who goes by the false name of Count Fujiwara perpetually after earning money through fraud, this no strings attached with anything kind of guy, and an asshole decides to con a Japanese heiress, Hideko, into marrying him for her inheritance. To help him with this scam, he hires this petty thief, seamstress Suki, and he convinces her to actually pay her to go and work as Hideko's handmaiden, thus the title, and then begin the games to keep you guessing who is conning whom and who will betray whom, because all three characters begin with similar motivations, a certain kind of freedom that money can and will bring them. It is as if blue is the warmest color and Wild Things had a baby that borrowed all the good things from the former and the twisty thrill from the latter. But just that, yeah? Not anything else from Wild Things. Even though both Handmaiden and Wild Things fall under the umbrella of erotic thrillers, The Handmaiden shows you how it is done. The first scene where we begin to catch hints of chemistry between Hideko and Suki, there's a bathtub, Hideko is naked in it. Suki averts eyes when the nakedness makes itself apparent, the perfect setting for eroticism. And yet, this is not where the eroticism comes from. Hideko cuts the inside of her mouth because of a sharp molar, and then Suki blunts it with this thing that she puts on her thumb, and this long scene of her thumb in Hideko's mouth is far more sensual than what it would have been had she just jumped into the tub. That's what it is. The magic is in the anticipation. There are two paces at which the film moves. The first is its strides for the thrill aspect, and the second is the slow build-up to, well, the climax. Again, not trying to spoil the film for you, but you know which two characters are going to fall in love. The suspense is whether the feelings can sway the original motivations or not. This is also my chief complaint from the film, not the falling in love angle. That kind of complicates things in the seemingly impossible plan. Because really, can you manipulate someone into marrying someone? On a second thought, it does happen in our country every day. So anyway, Hideko lives with the sleazy uncle who makes her perform erotic stories to gathering of guests, all men in case you were wondering, and wishes to marry her to inherit the estate. In this scenario, do you think she has a better option? She actually may consider the count even if she sees through his plan. She needs a way, but then again, this is also exactly why the con man needs the handmaiden. With everyone after her inheritance, how will Hideko even trust anyone? She needs to be coerced into trusting someone, so the handmaiden comes into the picture and they grow close. At different points, it seems they too are conning each other, but there is something about them. You know this is not what they planned and it is getting out of hand. And that is where it gets melodramatic. And that is a complaint that I was talking about. All was going so well, the smart plot with hints of betrayal here and there and the selfish people trying to deceive each other. But then there is this overly dramatic falling in love. Again, I do not have a problem with the love story. I have a problem with it being unnecessarily dramatic. Like, there is this scene that is supposed to show how much Suki cares for Hideko, how she really, really cares for her. And Hideko realizes it, and at a particular point, Hideko sits on a branch with a rope around her neck, and this tree is also kind of important in the story, but I won't go there. She is sitting on this branch. The other end of the rope is tied to the branch. She slips off to hang herself to death, but is caught midway by Suki. Just so toxic and annoying, by the way. Because I did not expect this dramatic falling in love. I thought it would be subtle, simple, gripping their hearts before they realize it, like the eroticism in the film. But sadly, no. It is Suki's visibly angry face when the Count looks at Hideko and her stomping away as the Count makes moves at Hideko. It is elaborate and visible and out there, as if without it you would not be able to understand there's love brewing between these two. In contrast to the sexual tension that lingers in looks and soft touches when they dress each other, and it's not just my personal bias against grand gestures kind of love. It just does not fit in the setting. Take Suki's character. She is Hideko's handmaiden, and being one comes with curbed audacity. You cannot afford to have audacity in this scenario. Your head always held down, voice always low, and body ready to reflexively act on the orders even before they're given. How is she suddenly breaking this character and audaciously disapproving of the Count's moves? And if we take into consideration that Hideko knows where Suki's anger is coming from, given they have reached a certain level of shared authority in their secret closeness, that does not show anywhere else, even in their most intimate moments. There's this imbalance. They are alone, but there's always this imbalance. And Suki obeys Hideko like a handmaiden is expected to. And that brings us to the question of identity. The Korean identity is a motif in the film, and it is the recurrence of this that reveals the setting in its truest form. In Japan-occupied Korea, in the 1930s, the average Korean like Suki, even the Count himself, though he's a bit better off than Suki, they want to escape to Japan for a better life. The way we're told Japanese people of the time and the setting perceived Koreans is very indicative of how othering happens. And would colonization even happen if not for othering? So there's these distinctive remarks on how Japanese people are more beautiful, or beautiful in general, because they don't consider Korean features to be decent enough. They are believed to be more civilized. Various Korean people are distinguished by their ugly features. Quite a few times in the film, something like language that absolutely informs your identity comes up several times. All of this hints towards the fact that this is not just about surface level pretense and conning, but their realities as well. Their realities are also in a crisis. Hideko came to Korea when she was 5. She's a Japanese person living in Korea. Her home country occupies her current home. Her current home keeps her hostage in ways more than just not being able to leave. Depending on the need of the hour, the characters also switch between languages, switching to identity that favors them the most. Then you can also correlate the layered structure of the plot to that of identities in general. It takes time to get to know someone, and there are layers to who a person is. Think of your parents. They are, well, your parents, but probably someone who could not have any flaws according to the child you. They love you too much, and you grow up and realize your mom is not just a mom. She has been this individual person since before you came into the picture, and this person does and can make mistakes. Even the way they show their love can be flawed along with being what makes them your mother. As mentioned earlier, there are three acts. The first one, when Suki goes to Hideko's mansion as the handmaiden. Second, when we find out everything is not exactly what it looks like. And third, the aftermath of the plan that Count had to con Hideko. As the plot proceeds, we revisit some of the scenes and the meaning changes and keeps you on the edge of the seat if you're not thrown by the occasional over-the-top drama. Take the house, for example. It's partly Gothic Victorian structure and partly Japanese traditional architecture. The film explains why is it so in the beginning. It's just Hideko likes both kinds of architecture. It is an interesting fusion, a confirmation of the prevalent layers in the film and a nod to the source material, The Fingersmith, the 2002 novel written by Sarah Waters. In the original work, the setting is Victorian. Waters says that the adaptation has managed to stay true to it all despite the major change in setting. She also explains what these big houses with rooms after rooms symbolize, which I honestly did not notice or even think about. In an interview with The Guardian, she explains that the layers represent social structures, public or semi-public spaces, then private and secret spaces. And isn't it true? Are you the same person in your living room and in the kitchen and in your own room in your own house? The spaces influence your identity a lot more than you think it does. There's a room in our house. Well, it used to be. We're rebuilding the house. Wow, I had not realized that place does not exist anymore. But yeah, there was this room in my childhood home where we hoarded all the cupboards that the other rooms did not have space for. I was my mom's best friend in that room. I kid you not, it was the part of the house that was far in one corner, away from the living room, away from other rooms, had the three cupboards in which my mom kept her extra saris and allowed us to discuss other family members far from anyone's earshot and things like that. But that rarely happened in my own room. Most things my mom would say had something to do with the way I kept the room, and I'm not even an unorganized person. The dynamics just shifted. Also, it was closer to other parts of the house, so I don't know. Maybe this is not relatable to you or it's just a bad example, but you can just go with Water's word over mine. Hideko is made to performatively read pornographic literature written by her sleazy uncle, an act that is supposed to be sensual but not a pleasure to her. A beautiful representation of how sexuality is imposed on the female body while denying it the right to pleasure. Maybe this is why the sex scenes are as graphic as they are in the film. I did question it. Did it need to be as graphic? You know, like one would maybe question throughout Euphoria. Did we really need to see Cassie as naked and as many times and as much as we do? Definitely not. But with The Handmaiden, I'm leaning towards yes. Maybe it did need to be as graphic as it was. Like, really, it's straight up cinematic porn. But in this case, it really was a part of the plot. And again, not in a singular, superficial way that this is a lesbian love story, so let's just scissor it up. Wow, that's not even a phrase. Anyway, but even the need for the sexual content is layered, as everything in the film is. Firstly, it's a plot point. But then, one might think that even if it is an important plot point, a revelation of who might be deceiving whom while being the naked truth of how something beyond deception is happening here, and this is something that is not in their control, the book and the film are a commentary on pornography, sexuality, and the female gaze, and the graphic scenes act as subversion. But then again, it is directed by a man, and then the writer is a woman and also a lesbian who approves of it. So who am I to question it? That being said, and understanding the need for it, I still would say that I would have liked some things to be left to the imagination, because that would have kind of been a cherry on the top, adding to how secretive the whole film has been. In the next episode, we are going to Iran to meet a man on a mission to find someone to do something important for him. And that's about it. I can't give you anything more about the plot because there really is not much to the plot.
Do check out the podcast Instagram page @aroundtheworld_8mm to find more hints and other cinema-related content. This page will also lead you to what I am up to, that is, if you're interested. Find us on Instagram and let's talk films. And hey, don't forget to treat yourself with a good film this week.